Hallo und herzlich willkommen zu der zweiten Starke Kost Staffel. In dieser Staffel spreche ich mit Menschen aus verschiedenen Ländern über die Folgen der Klimakrise in ihren Herkunftsstaaten. Wie verändert sich die Umwelt, die Landwirtschaft, die Arbeitssituation und nicht zuletzt auch die Ernährung in Ländern des globalen Südens? Was sind die politischen Maßnahmen, die dem entgegenwirken können? Und was können wir hier vor Ort vielleicht auch tun? In dieser Folge spreche ich mit Charles. Charles studiert zum Zeitpunkt der Aufnahme Migration and Intercultural Relations in Bremen und ist als Klimaschutzbotschafter Teil des Projektes Klimagesichter. Er berichtet über seine Arbeit in seiner Heimat Simbabwe und vor welchen Herausforderungen die Landwirtschaft dort steht. Welche Rolle dabei die Saatgutproduktion spielt, erfahrt ihr in dieser Folge. Mit dabei ist auch Yara von der Deutschen Klimastiftung in Bremen. Sie arbeitet im Projekt Klimagesichter und stellt uns das Projekt genauer vor. Das Gespräch haben wir auf Englisch aufgenommen. Jetzt erst einmal viel Spaß beim Hören. So, hello and welcome to a new episode. This is actually my second episode in English, so I'm very excited. I'm right now in Bremen in the office of the Deutsche Klimastiftung, and I'm not alone, and I'm here with Charles and Yara. Charles, would you like to introduce yourself?
Yeah, thank you so much. My name is Charles Murata. I'm from Zimbabwe. Currently living in Germany, doing my master program in European master in migration and intercultural relations.
Okay, Yara?
Hi, my name is Yara Yara Behrens, and I work for the Klimagesichter project. In English, it's called Climate Exchange. And in the project, we have people like Charles, who come from a different country, who can participate or play or a podcast like this one. So our project has coordinated, some of the guests for the podcast today, and we are happy to be here.
Yeah, me too. So I already warned you there's going to be a category, and the category is explain to your 10-year-old self what you do and why. Charles, do you want to start?
Yeah, I can start. Initially, I wanted to be the president of Zimbabwe. That was okay. my hope. You know, when I was very young, I used to emulate the president, former president of Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe. And I wanted to be one, like, okay, I should rule this country. I should transform the political landscape of the country. I should transform the economic structure. I must do that. But later on, you know, I then pushed patience and lack of money to proceed, you know, academically. So my academic road was bumpy and wasn't that straight. So at the end of the day, I, you know, attended secondary school, you know, in a very kind of remote area, and I didn't have enough money to fund my education system, and my parents were not able to afford because of the political and economic situation. But at the end of the day, I managed, you know, to proceed after my secondary education to university. But the university wanted to do some program with, where I tried by all means to try to transform my own community, looking at what the organization in my area called the Chikukwa Ecological and its Community Trust was doing in terms of resuscitating the environment, trying to encourage adaptation to climate change. So I wanted to participate in that project. So development studies was the perfect program for that. So I did, and then come back to work with them in 2018.
Okay, yeah. So we'll dig into that later, but first, Yara, like, how would you explain your job to your 10-year-old?
So when I was 10, or maybe even a bit younger, I always invented languages, and I used to be a very busy businesswoman, so I used to be always on a play phone that I had, and I used to speak in languages that didn't exist, but that's how I imagined my life. And now I think I'm very lucky, because in the project we work with so many different nationalities, so many people with their own story, and we help them to, to tell their story in their own way, and to have a stage in Germany to talk about climate justice and climate change in their home country. So those are big words. For my 10-year-old self, I think I wouldn't be able to understand, but it's all about injustice in the world and that we should see each other as people rather than seeing each other as opponents or, yeah, different from each other. We should see each other equal and as people.
Mm-hmm. Charles, you already started talking about the projects you did in Zimbabwe. Like, what kind of projects did you do and how was it related to climate crisis?
Yeah, we had a broader project called Natural Resources Management. And that natural resource management project is targeting rural farmers or subsistence farmers to try by all means to adapt to climate change. So the on sustainable agricultural related project like that, we focus much on seed production, on seed conservation and seed sovereignty for food security for farmers, for subsistence farmers. So on seed security, we try by all means to make sure that farmers utilize and use their own seeds. Then we also have what we call holistic land and livestock management, which is targeting, improving soil fertility in farmlands, but at the same time, improving fertility in rangelands and maintaining those rangelands as catchment areas because we want that environment to be more sustainable in terms of two broader projects which are related to climate change. Yeah.
What is the problem with the seed production? Like, can you explain a little further?
Yeah, what I've noticed is that, and what is well known even the whole country, that we have a problem of burgeoning corporate businesses in terms of seed production, and they push forward the agenda of seed production and for profit making. So they end up, pushing subsistence farmers to the periphery because they could not keep their own seeds. And government, at the end of the day, buy seeds from those corporate industries and then redistribute that seed to rural farmers. And those rural farmers, because they are in poverty, they could not resist that. They end up receiving that seed, but it is killing them actually in terms of their own seed sovereignty and seed sustainability. Because they end up receiving that one and ignoring their own seed. And their own seed, when I mean their own seed, them nutritionally, because they consider those seeds nutritious. They consider those seeds also healthy for them. They also consider these seeds very adaptive to the natural environment. So if the government now pushes forward the agenda of these corporate business, big business companies, they are destroying the capacity of rural farmers to produce and maintain their own seed. That is the biggest challenge that I've noticed with seed in my country.
What is the variety of seeds or like products which are typical for Zimbabwe?
Yeah, we have maize as the major staple food. Yeah, we cook what you call sadza, and that is the biggest kind of the largest staple diet. But at the same time, we have those which are, neglected, and they are really important, which is finger millet. Finger millet is the best because they consider it very nutritious. They produce porridge. They cook porridge. They can cook sadza using that finger millet. And it is also crucial because they also prepare like what they call mahew. I can put it in shona like that. And it is very nutritious for the kids and also for the elderly. And that is really, really important. And it is now being neglected as well because production of that finger millet is deteriorating at a very massive rate. But it is one of the most stable food products in the rural setup.
Yara, do you also know from other Klimagesichter about like this kind of problems, like with seeds and like the lack of variety in seeds and stuff like that?
Yes, we have a lot of people who talk about local farming and rural production, because it's very important for the food security in most of the countries. Yeah, I think what is very special for us is that Charles, you know so much from a local organization because you worked for them for many years. So your experience is also very interesting in that regard.
Charles, I think you already started on like talking about the consequences of climate crisis in Zimbabwe, but do you have like more examples? Like what's happening?
Yeah, in terms of climate change, I can think about it from the previous moments when I was even very young. We used to receive a lot of rainfall in my country, like in my community, because I live in the eastern parts of Zimbabwe, which is Chimanimani. So in that area, we used to receive like 1,200 milliliters of water per year. But later on, I've noticed that we are having late rains. Like we used to receive rainfall starting from October. But you know, it allowed, you know, that during that time for farmers to do early planting. But now we are noticing that we are receiving rainfalls in December, for instance, first rains. And it affects farmers then to do their planting. So we are experiencing droughts, reduced rainfalls, and then we are also experiencing excessive rainfalls as well. So it's kind of a dual marginality to farmers to experience that double-edged kind of a sword, where you see this year you experience excessive rainfall and the following year you experience drought. So it kind of affected the mitigatory measure or the adaptation measure for farmers. So in terms of we have excessive rainfalls, but at the same time we have droughts, and those droughts comes with also increased temperatures. And those temperatures also affects, you know, farmers' production, of food production and everything, and even livestock production as well. It's also being affected. So in other words, these are the major kind of problems that we have. And when I noticed that decline in food, in rainfall, decline, and also increased in excessive rainfalls, I've noticed some cyclones, some very massive cyclones, like the one that hit the country in 2019. And that was so devastating. And we also even received some funding from European partners, received some funding from United States of America to assist, you know, in terms of response, because our government was not even prepared. So when I notice all these kind of challenges that we are facing regarding climate change, I'm also noticing that the government do not have the capacity to prepare, because we have to follow the whole disaster management cycle. And when following that disaster management cycle, the government does not have the capacity to prepare. The government does not have the capacity to respond. The government does not have the early warning system of all these climate hazards. So at the end of the day, it is the rural kind of a farmer, or even some urban areas, who suffer from these climate change-related challenges.
In 2019, were there people displaced because of the cyclone?
We have a lot of displacements. I think around 150-something thousand people were displaced, and that is actually devastating. You know, when you are removed from the place that you used to live, and some graves were washed down, and people still, we are struggling to rebuild. Actually, because we had a lot of infrastructure destruction, we lost a lot of human lives, we lost a lot of properties, and that actually affects, because the government do not have the capacity to rebuild back that environment, and those who are displaced do not have the capacity to now adapt to the new environments that they are living. Yeah.
And you mean adapt in terms of language or what do you mean by adaptation?
Yeah, when I mean by adapting, I mean by adapting is that we are not talking about, because they are living with the same people, same language, same everything, but you are coming, for instance, from an area where you used to produce enough food for yourself as a family. For instance, and you used to receive a lot of rainfalls, like 800 mils in your per year in your environment, where you are now receiving 300 milliliters of rainfall per year. That is a signal which calls actually for an urgent adaptation skills, because you need to change the farming system, which you have been doing for the past years. Like for the rest of your life, you're used to farm in a certain way, and you are now forced now to change that farming pattern.
And so there's also a lack of knowledge about what is happening and how to adapt to the change.
Yes. Yes, that is the greatest issue of adaptation. When I talk of adaptation, you need to change the farming system, for instance, because you are displaced from the area that you grew up, and the farming system that you used to practice when you were in the former area, then now you are displaced. You need to find some relative ways to that particular environment. Yeah.
And would you say that people who are affected by the cyclone left the country, or most of the people just stayed in the region or in the country?
No, most of them are in the country. Mm-hmm. I can say there are some very few, I think. I'm not too sure. I don't have statistical figures on that. But I can say they might have been moved to Mozambique, some of them, because, you know, cyclones are being experienced largely on the border with Mozambique in Chimanimani. And there are some possibilities that a person might have relatives in Mozambique, and it is easy, you know, to move to stay in Mozambique after maybe there is a need on, you know, of checking whether there are some possibilities of such scenarios. But at the same time, most of people are displaced within the country. So you move maybe from Chimanimani eastern part, and then you move to the western part of the country. And there were also some kind of organized displacement programs where the government in partnership with different organizations like World Vision, they built some houses, but that was for very few people actually. But the rest have to find their own ways, you know. After this being displaced, you are forced to find where you can go and stay. Some were even displaced within the same region or within the same community. But you used to live here, but you are now forced to move maybe to your relative and ask for a piece of land to also build another house, you know, so that you can stay, because your former area is not inhabitable anymore. So that was mostly what happened. Relocation process or resettlement process by the government. It was for very few people who were staying in kind of urban area of Chimanimani. Yeah, there's an urban, kind of suburban kind of an area in Chimanimani that was affected severely.
You mean urban? Yeah, urban.
Suburban, I cannot call it urban actually. We call it village. Mm-hmm. But the village which has an organized setup. So that those people who were living in those specific areas were the ones who were, you know, organized by the government to have some kind of resettlement process. Mm. And they are also uprooted actually from their connections, their networks. So you have now to start staying in a different environment, and you need to think of how do you move now to your job, for instance, because some of them were teachers, nurses, and so on, who were living in a kind of a village organized system. But yeah, those in rural areas do not have any kind of set up a program, you know, in terms of relocation.
That's what we talk about a lot as well. Climate change mostly affects people who are on the, like, already have less means, mm-hmm. because obviously they don't have the possibility to campaign for themselves to get resettlement or to get their house rebuilt. And most of the times, governmental programs or even development or aid programs are not able to reach all of these people being displaced by climate change, extreme events, caused by climate change, simpler, like the cyclone that you mentioned in 2019. Mm. Yeah, it's one of the problems that it's affecting mostly the poor people in the country already on the marginalized side of the society. Mm-hmm. And then they are uprooted. They are losing everything. Healthcare and also, I mean, means to sustain themselves.
So you already talked about the lack of capacity of the government. Like what are political conditions that would have a positive impact? Like what do you think the government in Zimbabwe has to do? But also like what can Europe do, or the EU, or also Germany? Like where are the connections?
I think the escape that I imagine could be in my country is to change even the perception of the government. What we have seen is the electoral kind of problems, which are also cascading down to the whole economic condition as well as the political political situation of the whole country. Number one, there is always electoral violence whenever we are having elections in my country. And that is actually the biggest challenge in terms of our own justice as well as, living in harmony as a country. Always when you have elections, we experience some kind of, claims that elections were rigged, for instance. We always claim here that there was some political violence, opposition parties were being beaten. So peace and sustainable development starts from there, I remember from Amata Sen when he talked about development as freedom. That should be the starting point where we see development starting from the freedom to vote, freedom to express yourself. That is an example where people will be able to advocate for their own rights. And if we have a political reform, and political reform is not, it cannot just, be given on a silver platter, but it needs partners to also promote the electoral reform of that particular country. So I think as a watchdog, to make sure that they put pressure on the government to reform its political landscape in terms of electoral issues, which are still continuing. Even the last election was contested by the opposition leader that they were not free and fair. They were not credible and they were rigged. That exactly also means that people are not free to express themselves when it comes to these other issues like farming, climate change, and so on. What more then to the rural farmer who is in the rural landscape, rural area, could not even raise the hand, could not even stand up and say, we need things to be done in this way. So the political landscape, if it is changed through some political reforms, then definitely we will have a starting point in terms of how can we enhance justice to these rural farmers. That is how I see it. And maybe because we also have some other challenges, like, we have some policies which are still existing, or some acts which are still existing, and they are very rhetoric and archaic, I can put it that way, whereby we have AIPA and POSA policies, whereby people are not allowed to gather, people are not allowed to express themselves, and they have to seek consent always whenever you want to protest for anything. So at the end of the day, you cannot even raise your own voice. Yeah. So government should at least, if there are some freedoms enshrined in policy and in act, then definitely it would lead to transformation. But at the same time, there is much need of supporting or advocating for these farmers' rights, where the government should enact policies which are related directly to climate justice and climate change. Because I've noticed that rural farmers do not have the means, to adapt. But at the same time, the whole government do not have. So how then can we capacitate the government? It is actually starting from the acts themselves, where the government should find ways, and it cannot currently because they do not have the capacity, but maybe with external funders they can transform the whole situation. Yeah.
And it's definitely what you're saying, a plea to end corruption, because it feeds into the, as we talked about, the seed production companies taking over the market, and feeds into them benefiting from the system as it is, and like keeping the status quo.
Yeah, you are very right. When you see it from that from that side as well. You see that corruption is actually governance from the top government up until to the, you know, rural government system, whereby the society itself do not have the means to change it. It's corruption which is affecting everything. You see, when we talk about seeds, they're pushing forward the agenda of these bigger seed companies. The government is benefiting from that because they have to buy seed from those bigger companies. When buying seed from those bigger companies, they can even embezzle funds in that way. And then they make profit out of it because they pocket a lot of money into their own hands. And at the end of the day, who is paying for that seed? It is also those people, because it's taxpayers' money which is being used to buy the seed. And then they pay more. There's no auditing. There's no one who is going to put some checks and balances on the government expenditure. And they benefit from that whole system. And for them, they want to keep it like that. It should continue in their own sense, because when it continues, it helps them to keep embezzling government funds. Yeah.
If there was no corruption and freedom of speech, like, what could a positive future in your region look like, and what do you wish for?
Yeah, if there were no all these things, I would see a political reformed nation whereby there are some, freedoms of expression, freedoms of movement, freedoms of everything, whereby whenever you see that there's inequality, or there's lack of justice, you can rise up and also protest and tell the government to change the whole setup, the whole system. But now, because there is nothing like that, but at the same time, if there was political harmony, peace and everything, I would also see farmers being able to practice without fear, you know, in terms of their own farming systems. I would also see the government, which has a listening ear to the concerns of these rural farmers, where they can enact policies when necessary, you know, in terms of independence of these rural farmers, in terms of utilization of their own seed. I would love to see it, you know, in policy as well as in practice. What are they going to do? What should they do? They should also provide funding for these rural farmers to adapt. When you talk of adaptation, farmers cannot adapt by just the mere words this way. No, it is supposed to be funded, heavily funded. By who? By the government. But if there is no peace and security and freedom of expression, government is not pressured to do any adjustments, to fund any climate-related programs. So that exactly affects the farmers, because it is going to be something that is going to be recurrent for the next, I think, 30 years if it is not changed.
Okay, thanks a lot. Now I have another category from our series, which will be the last question for the two of you, actually. Yara, do you maybe want to start? The question is, what is your favorite food or product from your region?
A favorite food from my region. So to be honest, I'm quite locally whenever I buy apples, because all of the region, we live in Bremen, and obviously in all the supermarkets you get regional apples from Altes Land. So I love to do a apple pie or cake.
I would say, it's a kind of a finger millet porridge, because I really miss that one already. Yeah, we used to produce that finger millet porridge and sadza. I don't like sadza from that finger millet much, but I like porridge from that. And I think if I can get it, because you mix it with the peanut butter and it's very nutritious as well.
Okay.
Yeah.
So thanks a lot. And I wish you all the best for the future.
Das war die dritte Folge der zweiten Starke Kost Staffel. Danke an das Projekt Klimagesichter. Das Projekt wird von zwei Partnern geführt, der Deutschen Klimastiftung mit Sitz in Bremen und dem Unabhängigen Institut für Umweltfragen mit Sitz in Berlin. Klimagesichter wird gefördert durch die Nationale Klimaschutzinitiative des Bundesministeriums für Wirtschaft und Klimaschutz. Abonniert uns gerne und folgt unserem Instagram-Kanal @einewelt_mv. Dort posten wir auch Neuigkeiten zu unserem Podcast. Die nächste Folge der Staffel erscheint nach einer kleinen Weihnachtspause am Freitag, den 3. Januar. Bis dahin euch eine schöne Weihnachtszeit und einen guten Start ins neue Jahr.